Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hello, welcome to The Bunker Daily. I'm Andrew Harrison. Today, sports washing, where questionable regimes with dodgy records on human rights and the environment lend their largesse to major sporting events in the hope that it'll take our minds off what they're up to. In January, human rights activists called for a boycott of the Paris to Dakar car rally over Saudi Arabia's imprisonment of Loujain Al-Hathloul, who, ironically, had been campaigning for women's rights to drive. Al-Hathloul was released this month in a separate move, which was seen as an overture to Joe Biden. Meanwhile, MPs are urging British Olympic athletes to boycott the 22 Beijing Winter Games over China's genocidal abuse of the Uyghurs and the involvement of Qatar, a country with a catastrophic human rights record in world football, from its purchase of Paris Saint-Germain to its partnerships with Bayern Munich, Roma and Real Madrid to its shady acquisition of the 2022 World Cup, have all been seen as among the most egregious examples of sports washing. How bad is this problem, and what can we do about it when world sport is so dominated by money and geopolitics? Here to explain it all to me is Murad Ahmed, sports editor of the Financial Times and co-chair of the FT Business of Football Summit. Hello, Murad. Thanks for joining us. Are you decompressing after the least exciting transfer window ever?
I quite enjoyed this transfer window because it was a slightly different story, I have to say. I could write about Brexit and COVID and all the effects on the transfer window. So I quite liked the lack of activity. I came into my own.
Yeah, it was like the chill out room of football, wasn't it? It was like the sort of, you know, come in and relax and keep your blood pressure down. So on the sports washing, how serious is this issue? I mean, you wrote a piece about a year ago with the headline, "The Gulf Could Own Global Sports Soon." Is it that big?
It is that big at the in the upper echelons of sports. I mean, what we've seen over several years is that what was once sports ownership, holding events, might have the largesse of a wealthy individual. Sometimes that wealthy individual also wants to manage their reputation as well and be associated with sport for that reason. We're seeing those basic tactics play out on a corporate level, but also, as you were saying, you know, on a geopolitical level, particularly with Middle Eastern countries having a kind of proxy war to their regional rivalries on the playing field.
So is sports washing distorting the business of sports as well as just eroding whatever kind of moral standards we like to tell ourselves that the various sports have? Because the days, as you mentioned, the days of a local used car salesman buying your team to glory are kind of long gone, aren't they?
Absolutely. So, I mean, the sport I write about most is football. It's the world's most popular sport and gathers tons of attention and will continue to do so. But you can see very clearly the ways that the sports market, the football market, has been completely distorted by ownership of say, Middle Eastern states. So, you know, let's take Paris Saint-Germain. A few years ago, they bought the Brazilian forward Neymar for €222 million. This was more than €100 million more than any transfer fee ever played for a player. And I've spoken to lots of European football executives since, and they said in the years after that, it completely distorted the market, completely distorted what the top price of a player was, led to a lot of price inflation as the other big clubs in Europe looked to compete. the one thing that's managed to dampen that down is the reality of the pandemic. And we've seen everything come back to some sort of normality on the price front. But it gives you an idea, a very real world example of how distorting it can be when you throw petrodollars at football.
We've often been told to look out for the emergence of the European Super League and the kind of a global elite competition, which puts domestic leagues kind of out of the picture. Do you think that this kind of investment and the introduction of, as you say, petrodollars for the enhancement of reputations of problematic countries is likely to bring us towards that feared end state?
I'm not sure whether or not it's going to bring us closer to that. I think what it means is that you can't envisage a breakaway Super League in, say, European football without those entities being involved. If 20 years ago you were having a breakaway Super League, it would not involve Manchester City, which is now owned by Sheikh Mansour of the UAE, nor would it involve Paris Saint-Germain, which is since been taken over by the Qatari state. But their wealth have made them relevant factors in European football, and now you can really envisage a European Super League without them.
A lot of people would say that anybody involved in sports sponsorship of any kind is trying to change perceptions. And they might ask, well, why is a Russian gas company or a Gulf kingdom any worse than, say, a trainer manufacturer who, may require constant monitoring to make sure that it's not making its trainers in sweatshops, or a fast food company for that matter? They might say, is there a particular real moral difference here?
Thankfully, I don't have to make moral judgments in my reporting. I have to say it as I see it in that sense. And look, as I report for the Financial Times, we've traditionally not seen money as a immoral factor in the way the world works. I think the vast difference that we're seeing is that there's been those associations with sponsors and corporate groups have tended to be less to do with a reputational incentive and more to do with the profit incentive. It's very hard to see, although, and I've spent time with Manchester City executives, for example, and Paris Saint-Germain executives, they say that longer term, their ownership of these football clubs is to find new revenue streams that will diversify their nations away from natural resources. And this is a kind of a longer term game. You invest now, you reap the benefits later. There's no doubt that what a lot of the people involved in these clubs would do is when, you type in Abu Dhabi into Google, they would much prefer a load of links popping up on Manchester City's exploits than their human rights records.
Yeah. We've mentioned a few examples of sports watching, but for you are the most damaging to sports? Which are the instances where, rather than, holding one's nose as hundreds of millions come into your football club, it's actually damaging your club or the game?
Damaging is a difficult word, but I think the incident that really brought it home to me in recent years is the attempted takeover of Newcastle United by a consortium led by the Saudi Arabian Sovereign Wealth Fund, which essentially is run by Mohammed bin Salman, the de facto ruler of Saudi Arabia and the crown prince of that country. The way that the consortium addressed Newcastle fans and the public was that, this was their way of investing in a region that had been underinvested for years, if not decades. It's their takeover of the club. They really love the region. And that really didn't seem to stack up to the truth. What actually seemed to be is an extension of a regional rivalry with Qatar, principally, but also their ally in the Gulf, the UAE. And it was a kind of copycat maneuver at that level. But the problem with all of that is one of the other things that was going on was Saudi Arabia were, and the World Trade Organization have said this, but they were helping to infringe intellectual property rights by essentially hosting or in other ways being associated with a pirate television network called BeOutQ. BeOutQ essentially took the stream of a Qatari broadcaster called BeIn, which had paid billions for the rights for things like the Premier League and the World Cup and other sporting events, and was really undermining the way that the sports business had worked by kind of their association with this pirate network. And so you, in this intricate way, you're starting to see all the ways that once groups are starting to see sport as a proxy battle, that eventually the sports industry itself, the clubs, the leagues, get caught in the crossfire. And that's what happened with the Newcastle takeover. Basically didn't happen, partly because the Premier League were concerned that the Saudi state was involved and hadn't done enough to address their concerns about piracy.
So essentially Saudi Arabia had behaved on a grand scale like the dodgy pub at the end of your road with the hooky stream from the unusual provider.
With access to satellite technology that could to really make sure that your stream never went down.
Amazing. Does sport washing, does it work? Is the data to support the... you know, the obvious goal that, you know, it's about reputation enhancement, but also, as you say, it's about proxy conflict and gaining advantage and gaining kind of entree into economies that you otherwise wouldn't have.
It's a really difficult one to know how much it works, but I've spoken to human rights activists. They tend to say that actually it's a very successful strategy. So the person I speak to about this is a guy called Nicholas McGeehan, and he's a founder of a group called Fair Square. And he's often targeted by Manchester City fans, for example, on social media, this kind of weaponizing of fans to go after your critics, the country's critics, seems quite alarming to me. But he said, you know, he said to me, for every outraged liberal Westerner who disapproves of, if you want to call them sports washing, but their involvement in sport, there's, you know, thousands of kids all around the world running around with shirts with Etihad Airways over the front of them or Qatar over the front of them. So in that way, the global branding that football and sport has provided is already working. And if it wasn't working, why would Saudi Arabia be making a concerted effort to build up their sports industry at the moment?
I mean, I suppose also there's the factor that every football fan will recognise, which is you're very quick to criticise when it's happening to other people or other people getting involved in this. But when your own team is offered a potential investment of billions, suddenly the scales fall from your eyes, or maybe the scales go back on your eyes. Do you know what I mean? I mean, I'm a Liverpool fan, so I feel fortunate that Fenway Sport are not as problematic as certain owners. But, you know, does it ultimately fall back on the fact that fans will swallow anything as long as the money is coming in and success is on the way?
Yeah, I mean, fans are incentivized by the glory of their teams above else. I mean, they don't see themselves as customers. You know, no fan thinks of themselves as a consumer of a global brand, but I can tell you that the marketing directors of these clubs certainly do. You know, fans make an emotional decision usually around the ages of 8 and 12 years old. They get hooked on an association with a club, they consider it part of their identity, and they stick with it for decades. And actually, what has become the case as sport has become a business is that they've made a financial and economic decision which will stick with them for the rest of their lives. And so this is the thing that makes, you know, so-called sports washing such a potent tool if you can tap into it.
But other sports, I mean, I'm aware that we've talked a lot about football, that I'm inevitably going to do that as a football fan, but other sports have less of a partisan, particularly based on individual sports, such as motorsports. And they too are also being brought into the sports washing world, aren't we? We're seeing more and more boxing in the Gulf States. Motorsport has had a lengthy association with Gulf States for the petrochemical connection, which is now more problematic maybe than when the sports really became connected to that world. Do you see, outside of football, is sports washing as influential and powerful in those other sports?
Well, it depends what you're trying to do by sports washing. Like, sports washing is a derogatory term that a lot of human rights activists don't like using as well, because they see it as all the activity that's going on as more subtle than that. So you brought up things like motor racing going into the Gulf States. You know, Bahrain has a Grand Prix. Saudi Arabia will soon have a Grand Prix. Abu Dhabi has a Grand Prix in Formula One. The Paris-Dakar rally has been bought up by Saudi Arabia as well. And what what officials in those countries will say and have said is that what they are trying to do is they're trying to modernize their countries. They're trying to bring leisure activities and entertainment into their nations as a way of giving something to their incredibly young populations, give them these kind of leisure activities, also encourage them to take up sport themselves. Obesity is a big problem in the Gulf countries as well, and bring in new revenue streams, new tourists into the country, other ways of making money and having an economy in the future that works beyond just natural resources. So if you take them at their word, then having the Paris-Dakar rally being a massive advert for Saudi Arabia on screens around the world starts to make a lot more sense in a more direct way than kind of ephemeral ideas of branding and reputation management.
But it can work the other way, can't it? I mean, few people were as aware of Qatar's terrible human rights record as they are since it got the World Cup. It's now spending £200 million on infrastructure for the 2022 World Cup. There's now widespread understanding that people are dying while these stadiums are being built. Can there be a kind of a Streisand effect where actually your attempt to cleanse your reputation in public by this can actually draw attention to your failings?
Yeah, it's a really interesting point that I think a lot of the people who were involved in say bidding for the World Cup and so on, they didn't really fully thought through the kind of the backlash that would come and the scrutiny that would come from getting these events, particularly the ways that these events were acquired and these along the way, the kind of backroom dealing that occurred has really brought scrutiny to these countries, and they've had to make adjustments on and policy changes on workers' rights, which I think those people who advocate the Gulf states getting involved in sports say, look, a lot of this change wouldn't have happened if it wasn't for these investments in the first place. So you've always got to kind of balance that out. I think you're also starting to see signs that Qatar in particular will ramp back its investment after the World Cup in football and in sport in general, be in the Doha-based broadcaster, which says it doesn't have a connection to the Qatari state, but is owned by the Nasser Al Khalifi, who also runs Paris Saint-Germain. It has said that issues like piracy, issues like the value of sports rights, means that they're going to start ramping back on their spending on sports rights. That is suddenly a big player retreating from the sports market in a way that will not be good for, you know, sports franchises in Europe and across the world. So I think they, if they really thought that there was a good business model for it, you would imagine that they would stick with it. Actually, I think maybe they think their job is done, and I think you may see a ramp back at least from the Qatari side.
Just in closing, then, what can the average sports fan with their, you know, their multiple TV subscriptions and wanting to go to games when they can? What can we do about this incursion of, you know, problematic regimes and politically dodgy organizations into world sport? I mean, does it simply boil down to, if you don't agree with it, don't go, which is a tough decision for the committed sports fan?
But it's the only one that they have open to them. I can't speak to what activism that fans should take up if they are worried about this. What I can say is arm yourself with knowledge, arm yourself with a full understanding of the motivations, which, by the way, are much more varied and not necessarily sinister in all circumstances. But once you understand the world as a kind of nuanced place full of competing interests and factors, as well as ideologies, then you're starting to get a much better picture of what's going on. Unfortunately, sport, which is inherently oppositional, I support my team.
Go on, name your team. You know you want to.
Oh, my team is Manchester United. at least that is the team when that my family from Manchester, and as I was growing up, that was the team I was obsessed with. But equally, I'm more and more aware of how the club is run and it's run as a business. And my feelings of partisanship have reduced over time. I have a WhatsApp group of my cousins who go absolutely crazy during every single Manchester United match, and also consider me the worst enemy. I'm named a Liverpool fan for saying nice things about Jurgen Klopp. I think that inherently sport is all about partisanship, I'm sure. But take a step back for a bit, understand what you're supporting and what you're doing, and at least don't fall into the trap of being used as a tool of said regimes, if you want to believe that that's what they're doing, and going around and doing things like attacking activists and journalists on Twitter who don't agree with what's going on within the clubs.
One last thing: which of the world governing bodies are doing a good job on policing the involvement of problematic organizations and regimes that would perhaps damage the sport itself? Who's doing a good job and who's doing a bad job, do you think?
I have no list of anyone who's doing a good job.
Really?
It's not, look, fundamentally, this comes back to an idea of, if you see the world as a place of competing ideologies, this is a horrendous thing that needs to be fought against, and why aren't governing bodies dealing with it? But as a reporter at the FT, we tend to see the world as a place of competing interests, and there are financial interests and there are political interests, and sometimes they're just the interests of three men, incredibly powerful, who are the effective leaders of their country, in a kind of battle of wills and contests and bragging rights. And once you start seeing the world like that, you start understanding what's going on. And the governing bodies have their interest is essentially making money, and they have not shown, until the Premier League actually decided not to, or at least scrutinise the Newcastle United takeover very, very closely. Until then, it hadn't been clear to me that there was any evidence that any governing body in any sport wasn't going to take the dollar when it was offered to them.
What would you do if Qatar rang up to buy Manchester United? Would you be able to maintain your journalistic sang froid, do you think?
I think I'd be writing a lot of articles.
All right, Ahmed, thanks for joining us. Before you go, tell us a bit about the FT Business of Football Summit, which sounds intriguing.
Sure. On February 17th and 18th, we have a virtual football summit. We've run it for the last couple of years live in person, but we have some great speakers like Manchester United's Marcus Rashford, and he's talking about his child poverty campaign, the Premier League's chief executive, Richard Masters, Marcelo Kluwer, who's the chief executive of SoftBank, a huge company that's associated with various sports investments, various other people in and around the world of sport. It's a two-day program of us asking hopefully difficult and interesting questions to the powers that be in football. So do sign up and register if you think that that's your sort of thing.
Sounds good. Murad, thank you very much for joining us. It's been absolutely fascinating. Listeners, remember, you can help The Bunker by reviewing and rating us on Apple Podcasts, and also by backing us on Patreon. For a mere £2 a month, you can get all of our podcasts early, without adverts, in an exciting podcast wash. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
The Bunker Daily was produced and presented by Andrew Harrison. The assistant producers were Jacob Archbold and Yelena Sofronijevic. Audio production was by me, Alex Rees. Theme tune by Kenny Dickinson. The Bunker Daily is a Podmasters production.